This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, the fight for women's health has taken a new turn in Texas. 8 Planned Parenthood facilities throughout the Lone Star State have filed federal lawsuits against a measure recently signed by Governor Rick Perry that cut off Medicaid funding earmarked for women's health programs to all Planned Parenthood branches in Texas.
Well, Planned Parenthood continues to be front and center in the news this year, and that Texas law seeks to effectively shut down Planned Parenthood in that state due to what they say is the organization's support of abortion services. Of course, Planned Parenthood says those services are entirely privately funded and don't occur at those Planned Parenthood facilities. They say Planned Parenthood's primary service in Texas is to provide family planning, cancer, and other health care screenings to some of the state's poorest residents, and that means about 800,000 Texans per year who are served by Planned Parenthood.
Planned Parenthood is seeking an injunction against the Texas law, which cuts off Medicaid funding by the end of the month. The law is certain to lead to closures of facilities in some of the neediest communities in Texas. The federal government has already said it will cut Medicaid funds to Texas, earmarked specifically for women's health, because of the state's attempt to restrict freedom of choice of providers.
And federal courts have upheld similar challenges to the cutoff of federal dollars used for Planned Parenthood services in other states. So we'll see how this Texas fight pans out.
And the climate is always heating up. And there's an interesting report out there that should serve to silence some of the misinformation on the campaign trail and in Congress about the cost of health care reform in Massachusetts, which we all know is the first state in the nation to attempt universal coverage for all of its citizens. There have been numerous claims that it's cost the state billions of dollars to ensure almost all Massachusetts residents, about 98% coverage in that state through their universal plan.
The report from the nonpartisan Massachusetts Taxpayer Foundation does outline in great detail the cost of securing insurance coverage for the state's residents. And according to the report, the costs were actually close to what they expected they would be, $100 million, and that's about 1.5% or a little less of the state's total budget. So interesting to see how this plays into the discussion on the campaign trail.
Speaking of nonpartisan groups, factcheck.org's Lori Robertson joins us later in the show with a look at details in the Paul Ryan's GOP health care reform proposal, his answers to the Affordable Care Act, and whether it stands up to scrutiny.
Well, we look forward to that, Mark. And meanwhile, our guest today is Brian Dolan, the co-founder and managing editor of Mobi Health News. That's a leading online publication that looks at the myriad new developments in mobile health technology and analyzes thousands of health and medical apps that are out there for smartphones and tablets and gives us some insight into the ones that are likely to have the most impact on health, healthcare providers, and consumers in the future.
We'll get to Brian Dolan in just a moment, but no matter what the topic, you can find all of our shows by Googling CHC Radio.
And don't forget, if you have any comments, please send us an email at chcradio.com. We'd love to hear from you. In a moment, Mobi Health News Managing Editor Brian Dolan. But first, let's hear from our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with this headline news. Mitt Romney, the likely GOP candidate for president, is already on the hunt for the number two spot. Although he's remaining tight-lipped about potential running mates, analysts predict he is going to apply the same conservative business strategy and choose a running mate that will pose the least amount of risk. On the speculative shortlist, Marco Rubio of Florida, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, GOP budget overhaul author Congressman Paul Ryan, and former presidential hopeful Tim Pawlenty, all have expressed interest in repealing the Affordable Care Act. Meanwhile, Congressman Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, ranking member of the House Budget Committee, warned that while the Ryan plan has generated the support of Mitt Romney, it's not likely to make it through the Senate or be approved by the president. Van Hollen saying the plan shreds the social safety net. From the business page, mobile health is going to continue to trend upward. The development of health and wellness apps for consumers and medical professional use as well is expected to continue to grow, projected to be an $8 billion a year sector of the industry by 2018. I'm Marianne O'Hare with this headline news.
We're speaking today with Brian Dolan, managing editor and co-founder of the online publication Mobi Health News, a leading provider of news, commentary, online events, and research for the global digital health community. Mobi Health News analyzes the thousands of digital apps for medicine, health, wellness that are flooding the market, as well as the companies who make them and the policy shaping their eventual use in the growing mobile health marketplace. Brian, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, happy to be here.
Yeah, we're glad you're here with us.
Since you co-founded the publication in 2008, the digital world has dramatically exploded with new applications, with some analysts calling these technologies the sort of new gold rush in healthcare. It's been estimated that some 30 million apps are downloaded per day across the globe. The proliferation of smartphones and tablets like the iPad have generated thousands of startups and app developers hoping to deliver that game-changing technology for the future of healthcare delivery. It seems that you've picked the right area in the right time. Tell us what made you decide to focus your journalistic efforts on digital health.
Yeah, so, you know, my background is actually in the mobile and wireless industry. So I was a reporter there for a number of years. And around 2008, for the first time, I wrote about healthcare on mobile phones and realized, you know, we spent all this time finding ways to bring television to these tiny screens and finding ways to create an entertainment hub in your hand. Why haven't we spent, or it seemed like, why haven't we spent any energy on bringing health services to the phone, too? And we founded the publication the end of 2008. And at that time, you know, we were definitely very early. There wasn't much going on. It was actually very difficult to get people to talk about mobile technology and healthcare in the same conversation. It kind of seemed like an odd one then. Mm-hmm. But in the years since, I would say 2010, early 2011, this idea of mobile health became a dominant topic, both in the healthcare industry and in the mobile industry. If you went to events in either of those two industries, you would find that to be one of the leading topics of discussion at the time.
I think it's a great example of be careful what you wish for, because now you have a really daunting task that you've taken on of analyzing all of the medical and health apps in the marketplace. And I think your research estimates that of the millions of applications that are out there, maybe there'll be as many as 13,000 such apps available for download by mid-2012 just for Apple alone that target medical or health or wellness needs. And we recently had Dr. Eric Topol from the West Wireless Institute on the show, and he talked about this idea that mobile health devices are the frugal innovations of our age that have the potential to really impact the cost of healthcare delivery. And I'd be very curious, from your great range of expertise looking at these thousands of apps and devices, tell us what's impressed you so far as having the greatest potential to achieve that very desirable impact of frugal innovations.
So we do some tracking of the app stores, and we expect this summer there to be about 13,000 consumer-facing apps. So those are health apps for consumers. There's an additional almost 6,000 expected for professional users. So, but for the most part, yeah, it's around 20,000 apps that are health-related. And, you know, I really do like Dr. Topol's idea of frugal innovations, this idea that there's a lot of medical technology out there that's very expensive, and while it may help improve health outcomes, it's very difficult to kind of proceed and integrate those sort of technologies into the system, since we do have all these health cost issues. But that's really one of the reasons that mobile health is of such interest right now, is that it is, by its nature, inherently frugal. So you typically might not think of an iPhone or an iPad as necessarily a cheap device or an inexpensive device, but in the context of healthcare, it is. And having smartphones like that growing in adoption and finding their way into almost a majority of people's pockets here in the U.S., that's expected to happen in June, more than 50% of people are going to have smartphones in the U.S. And once we're there, this idea that you have this computer in your pocket, which is really, it connects you to the health system, potentially. And the frugal innovations that we see as holding the most promise are the many peripheral devices that are coming out that connect to those smartphones in your pocket or those iPads that you're holding, and streaming, you know, vital sign data, or you can take a blood test if you have diabetes, and that can go right through your iPhone and send it up to the cloud and accessed by your caregivers, mm-hmm. and your doctor and others. So there's a lot in the way of these inexpensive devices coming out for all sorts of chronic conditions that enable patients to better self-manage their own health mm-hmm. while at home.
You know, I want to pull the thread a little on the sort of division between the consumer and the professional apps. You put out a series of quarterly reports on analyzing the apps, and it seems to me that you've got more traction in the consumer market than in the healthcare arena. Why is the adoption of mobile health applications so difficult in the healthcare arena?
Yeah, you know, it's a tough question as to which is taking off, and, you know, in terms of the number of apps out there, and, you know, we include in that, because there's a spectrum of care, we include prevention and leading into fitness and wellness apps as part of that number. You know, those quality apps or those apps that are trying to address, you know, real issues are actually very few. And so I would say, you know, when you look at it in terms of who seems to be embracing this idea of mobile in healthcare more, I would actually argue it is the provider community that's doing that. Hmm. Especially physicians who have been found to be very aggressive adopters of this technology. Now it's up over 80% of physicians in the U.S. say they have either a smartphone or a PDA.
Is it that the technology just is coming online for them? Because clearly, if you looked at banking and other areas, technology adoption is far ahead of healthcare. So is it it just wasn't the right fit for the providers up to now?
Well, I think from from the patient side, the consumer side, the analogy with the banking industry, and it definitely does kind of make you scratch your head and say, well, if I can, you know, pay for my mortgage through my phone, why can't I access my health information? I mean, that's a question we hear a lot. As sensitive as banking information is, it's far more sensitive when you get into people's health data. You know, the privacy issues there are far more serious. So there's more complications and much more regulation, as well as fragmentation between, you know, health systems and having these systems talk to each other. So there's a lot of issues there as to why this doesn't work as a system yet. But at the same time, the consumer adoption of just simple smartphones and tablets is lagging providers. So the providers actually have the smarter devices. So, you know, you're already finding that physicians are using these devices to access their electronic medical records, you know, e-prescribing, accessing some of those hospital systems. So, yeah, no, I would actually argue that the providers are a little ahead when it comes to adoption of these devices and these services than the consumers are.
And, Brian, I don't want to leave out the role of the federal government in all this, because certainly for, must be at least 6 or 8 years now, the federal government has really been pushing the advancement of electronic health records, electronic health technology and communication in healthcare, certainly through the development of standards for meaningful use and the creation of the Office of the National Coordinator. But you had an article recently in Mobi Health News that pointed out that meaningful use, according to, if you look at those incentives and the policies, really applies only to the use of electronic health records and personal medical records and fail to incentivize the mobile component. And I think one analyst called this lunacy, since smartphones, as you point out, and tablets are really quickly becoming the preferred mode of communication. Be curious what your sense is of how healthcare reform and provisions in the Affordable Care Act are spurring, or where we maybe missed the boat on the adoption of the use of mobile technology in healthcare.
Yeah, no, it's certainly true that if there are any, they're very indirect mentions or incentivizations for using mobile in particular. But at the same time, there are a number of opportunities where mobile makes sense and is, in a way, indirectly mostly encouraged because of these meaningful use requirements. So, you know, I wouldn't say that there aren't opportunities that are arising because of it. I've heard people say there are dozens actually buried within that legislation. You kind of have to look for them.
It's a long document.
It is, yeah. And as you said, the analyst that sort of mentioned, you know, this is lunacy that we're not calling out mobile devices. I mean, the fact that he acknowledges that these devices are becoming the preferred mode of communication, I think just shows why it's kind of irrelevant. We don't need to specifically call out mobile because, you know, very quickly we'll find that physicians and other clinicians are using their smartphones and their tablets mostly to access these EHRs. So, you know, I don't think it's necessary to make the incentivization tied to any particular device. But if you want to achieve meaningful use, it's important that your providers actually use the systems.
We're speaking today with Brian Dolan, Managing Editor and co-founder of Mobi Health News, a leading provider of news, commentary, and research for the global digital health community. Their mission is to provide a trusted and insightful voice at the intersection of healthcare and technology. Brian, you've been a featured speaker at a number of events around the world related to global digital health. You've written and spoken about how the FCC needs to provide a broadband policy that will help facilitate growth and meaningful use of mobile technology, including in healthcare. Where do we stand now with the FCC in terms of the proper broadband governing policies?
Yeah, a few years ago, the FCC especially, they focused on this idea of how broadband, in particular wireless broadband, cellular data networks could enable wireless health services. And it was a pretty far-reaching document. But within that, I think the most important thing that they did, and it really actually, while the FCC does focus on broadband policy and, you know, wireless spectrum and some of these more technical things, the document was actually pushing for other agencies like CMS and, government payers for healthcare to actually take a look at some of these mobile health technologies out there and these applications and these devices and sort of fast-track and catalyze ways to reimburse for these services. But on the policy front, on the regulatory front, I think the most interesting and most important movement in the past year has really come from the FDA. One of the big question marks last year was, you know, if you have an application on a smartphone or on a tablet that is acting like a medical device, you know, what's the role of the regulator? Should these applications actually be looked at and regulated as traditional medical devices are? And the FDA actually came out with a preliminary proposal, basically, that they put up for discussion, and they found just that there is a group of apps they believe that do require FDA regulation. And we're sort of in the middle of that now. We're still waiting sort of for some final ruling on that as to how these existing regulations for medical devices apply to apps. But it's certainly been an interesting year for policy initiatives in mobile health.
Well, that raises a very fascinating area to look at if you move from the policy and regulatory to the personal. And I'd been about to ask you, since we've been talking generally about this area, if you had any particular apps that you found as you go through your research and writing that you think really are game changers in terms of helping to either improve public health, or any that, you know, two or three that you might like to describe. But second, what do you see as the state of research on this? And that's, I think, where the FDA weighs in. If the FDA is regulating something, they're looking for some pretty good randomized control trials. And do they do any harm? And I haven't seen a lot of research out there looking at the impact of mobile apps, and wonder if you have, and is that the kind of thing that you might write about in your journal?
Yeah, it absolutely is. Yeah, I'll take that second question first, because I think it's a nice follow-on from the FDA comment, as you said. So, you know, last year was kind of figuring out the regulatory landscape for these apps and services. And this year, you know, we expect, especially towards the end of this year, to kind of see more and more of these clinical studies come out, because there's a real emphasis now on efficacy. Do these, you know, if you're creating a service or an app in mobile health right now, it's definitely important that you can prove that it works, and that it's, you know, while it may be inexpensive, is it actually improving health outcomes? And it's true, yeah, there are not too many that have actually gone through that. Very few, actually, especially on the patient-facing side, that have gotten through FDA clearance and, you know, proven through a handful of clinical studies. I can actually count on one hand how many applications that have done that, but a few have led the pack and have certainly shown that it should be done, it can be done, and when you do it, it leads to better partnerships and you know, hopefully reimbursement soon. We're expecting some reimbursement rulings to come out and some payers to come out and say that they're going to now pay for some of these applications.
You know, Brian, let me pick up, because Margaret had just asked you about some of your favorite apps, and maybe you can add to that some of your favorite peripherals. You talked about that a little earlier.
Right.
These are simple attachments to your mobile phone that can turn it into a ultrasound, electrocardiogram machine, microscope, or whatever. Individual apps that you like, and some of these peripherals. So maybe give our listeners at Conversation sort of a list of some of the best out there.
It seems like if you can think of something that can be measured, or some sort of sensor device that could be out there, there's a good chance someone's currently or has already created a peripheral version of that that can interface with a smartphone. Just this past week, we wrote about two such sensors. You know, one was a take on a thermometer. It was an infrared thermometer that actually plugs into the iPhone, and without contacting, you can just hold it up to the patient's forehead or your own forehead and get a reading. And that goes right into an app, which can then be shared. So if you need to be taking temperature throughout the day or once a day, that's something you can track and trend via these apps. And another one, a little more innovative perhaps, was a wireless sensor patch. This is kind of like a Band-Aid that sticks to the person's skin, and it has some accelerometers in there that can detect motion. And this particular one called LumoBack is a device that can detect whether or not you're standing or sitting correctly with good posture. And so this is designed for people with lower back pain to sort of help them stand up straight and sort of mitigate the issues they might be having because of their poor posture. So just a couple of examples. I mean, the ones you mentioned on the provider side are certainly more sophisticated, and I think there's more of those further along, like the ultrasound peripherals. You mentioned an EKG. There are some devices out there that can be used both by physicians or by patients. You can take your own EKG with a very simple or easy-to-use device that actually interfaces with iPhones. That's coming to the market very soon. And there's a whole range of consumer-facing devices, including blood pressure cuffs that connect to the iPad or the iPhone. I mentioned glucose meters. There's the first one of those, a very tiny device, you know, about the size of your thumb, just plugs into the bottom of the iPhone and you know, feeds your glucose readings right into an app on the phone to be shared. So a lot of interesting things there. And I guess there are sensors already on the phone itself. So there's been some incidents where mostly researchers are using the accelerometers embedded in the device to detect, you know, if you have Parkinson's, you can kind of detect the tremors and quantify that. And then the last one I would mention, of course, maybe the most obvious sensor on the phone is the camera. And there's a lot going into using the smartphone camera to detect all sorts of things, whether it's you know, a dermatology use case for, you know, an abnormal looking mole. There's all sorts of algorithms that can be used now in analysis there, to using cameras to look into a patient's eye. You can start to get some non-invasive blood glucose readings that way too. So a lot of interesting things are certainly, you know, on the horizon, and, you know, I have no doubt they'll be connecting to some sort of smartphone device in the future.
I'm betting there's millions of moms and dads out there that would like that thermometer to travel with them via their iPhone. So thank you for that review. And Brian, we'd like to ask all of our guests this final question. When you look around the country and the world in terms of innovation, what other exciting developments are you seeing, and who should our listeners at Conversations be keeping an eye on?
things are going to get very interesting for my industry in mobile health, but in healthcare in general, once genomics starts to develop more. I see a lot of opportunities for genomics working in tandem with mobile sensors. It could lead to a lot of different things. And another field I would say is nanotechnology, some of these nanosensors that, you know, will make their way through the body. We could start to see sensors kind of powered by the pressure of the bloodstream, sending reports, again, to some sort of device the person is wearing or has with them. So things could get very interesting, I think, as this kind of technology finds its way actually inside the body, not just worn on the body or detecting things from it. I think that's where it's going, and certainly those are the kind of stories I expect to be writing about in the next couple of years.
We've been speaking today with Brian Dolan, managing editor and co-founder of the online publication Mobi Health News, a leading provider of news, commentary, online events, and research for the global digital health community. You can find him online at mobihealthnews.com. And on Facebook and Twitter as well. Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Hi, Mark and Margaret. This week, we'll talk about the new Medicare plan proposed by Representative Paul Ryan of Wisconsin and the claim from President Obama that seniors will bear more of the cost under that plan. We found the president was wrong on a key point. Ryan's plan would give seniors a premium support payment. It's like a subsidy that they'd use to get either private insurance or traditional Medicare. Seniors would pick a plan on a Medicare exchange. And this would start in 2023 for those who turn 65 that year. Now, what the president has said is that if healthcare costs rise faster than that subsidy, Obama calls it a voucher, then, quote, that's too bad. But Ryan's plan ties the amount of the subsidy to the second cheapest plan offered to seniors. So under his proposal, which is different from what Ryan put forth last year, the premium support would always be enough to cover at least two plans, the two least expensive ones. Now, how does the plan keep down the cost of those insurance policies? It says that the premium of the second cheapest plan can't grow faster than gross domestic product plus 0.5 percentage points. And if it does, Congress would have to step in and do something, find some way to lower those insurance costs. It's true that we don't know what Congress might or might not do in that case. The president is wrong when he implies that Ryan's plan would do nothing for seniors if health care costs rose at a faster rate. And that's our fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives.
When the federal government made changes in 2009 to the program that supplies food assistance to women, infants, and children, better known as the WIC program, it seems they set a healthy change in motion. The WIC program was originally designed to meet the nutritional needs of young women of childbearing age, pregnant women, infants, and young children. But many of these women live in food deserts and lack the transportation and the means to get to the supermarkets where higher concentrations of high nutrition foods can be found. Too often, the foods found at the convenience and local corner stores are high in fat, salt, and sugar, and low in fresh fruits and vegetables. Researchers at the University of Pennsylvania found that since the change in 2009 in the program, a change which offered WIC vouchers for things like whole grains, fresh fruits and vegetables, and low-fat dairy products, over 100 stores across two poor urban neighborhoods increased their availability of healthy foods by 32% in 1 year. And all of this was achieved not by spending more, but by offering new guidelines for how the vouchers could be spent by the recipients. While this study targeted a few specific urban neighborhoods, these trends are bearing out in other locations as well. Incentivizing small, independent convenience grocers to stock healthier foods to offer their customers, now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of Wesleyan University at WESU, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.